Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with tap to pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. So Money episode 1643, a live audience episode with Sarah LaFleur, founder of women's wear brand MM LaFleur.
You're listening to So Money with award-winning money guru Farnoosh Torabi. Each day, get a 30-minute dose of financial inspiration from the world's top business minds, authors, influencers, and from Farnoosh herself. Looking for ways to save on gas or double your double coupons? Sorry, you're in the wrong place. Seeking profound ways to live a richer, happier life. Welcome to So Money.
The negative way of saying it is you kind of start to disassociate. The positive way of saying it is you take the ups and downs. You're able to take both on the chin. And I think that's been very true of my entrepreneurship journey, where like this is like, we were just talking about it, right? Like having your own business is like the highs are so high and the lows are so low. I used to feel that way. I would say like I've over the past 3-4 years, especially during COVID, like I have found a little bit of even keelness, and I've been able to disassociate a little bit, which is hard because my name's on the door literally, but I found that to be like probably the most important, I'm going to say, life lesson even.
Welcome to So Money, everybody. I'm Farnoosh Torabi. A couple of weeks ago, I had the special opportunity to head up to the Upper West Side of Manhattan and sit down with Sarah LaFleur. She is the founder of MM LaFleur and a previous guest on So Money. She was on before the pandemic, and so we had a lot to catch up on. Sarah, over the years, has become a friend, huge supporter of my work. And so it was such an opportunity to be able to go to her in front of a live audience. Thank you to everybody who showed up on this night in February. We had to actually reschedule the event because of snow. And then the night of the event, now that it had been rescheduled, rained all day, all night. And so really appreciate everybody who decided to brave the weather and sit down with us for what ended up being a really powerful conversation about one entrepreneur's journey through COVID, carrying her New York-based fashion brand through the pandemic, the hard decisions that Sarah and her team had to make, and why, in some ways, the company is better off because of it. Sarah also gets very personal. Since she was last on the show before the pandemic, she has expanded her family. She now has 3 children, all similar in age. They're not triplets, but it's quite the story, and something that I think a lot of women and couples can relate to. A little bit more about MM LaFleur. Sarah founded the company in 2013 with a mission to help women take the work out of getting dressed so they could focus on what mattered to them. She named the company after her mother, whom she calls her biggest inspiration. And MM LaFleur donates 10% of its profits every year to organizations focused on gender equality, such as Bottomless Closet, the Girl Scouts, and the International Rescue Committee. At the heart of the company is the belief that when women succeed, the world becomes a better place. Could not agree more with that. Here's Sarah LaFleur and I talking sort of mid-introduction. We get right into it. Enjoy the show. This is a wonderful reunion. And ever since then, as I said, I've been a huge fan of you and the brand that you've built and the community that you're creating around story. Really, there's a story in everything that you do. And tonight's about Sarah's story. And I'm so excited for all of you to get to know her better. I interviewed her first, as we said, in 2017. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were making headlines because your revenue was killing it.
It was, yeah, I think it was a couple of years in, but we had a really slow start. So we actually, I quit my last job in 2011.
Okay.
And then it was like a snail of a start. And so even though officially our launch was not, it was 2013, I think what put us on the map, which was like a particular sales channel called Bento that we launched, that was not really until 2015. And so people were like, you came out of nowhere. And I was like, I feel like I've been slogging away for half a decade. Yeah.
It's always like that, right? Yeah. It always feels like the overnight success. Well, speaking of, because I think we would all benefit from your origin story. There's so many good nuggets there, but tell us about the origin story of MM LaFleur and why you started the company, which by the way is named after your mother.
It is. I mean, it is, MM is my mom's nickname. Actually, her nickname is actually Meme, which she's Japanese. It's kind of a childlike way of saying eyes, and she has really big eyes, and so that was her nickname. But Meme LaFleur, and LaFleur is my name, my last name, if in French, it translates into grandma flower. So after we launched the brand, my French friends were like, do you really want to call your brand grandma flower? Like, it just connotes something different. And I was like, you're right. I think we got to change that. So it like, I don't know. I think we had already like sold clothes with the Meme LaFleur hang tag on it, but we pivoted to MM LaFleur. And yeah, since then everyone's like Madame LaFleur, Monsieur LaFleur. Like we've heard everything, but it's MM LaFleur. And I started it really because I worked in a more professional field. I was in management consulting, and then I was in private equity coming out of college, and I really had a difficult time finding good clothing. I felt like the options out there were really like, you know, either it was you were paying a lot of money for clothes that weren't very fitted and not stylish. And I was just like, how am I spending so much of my paycheck on clothes that I don't like? Mm-hmm. And then if I went slightly more expensive designer stores, it felt like nothing was actually appropriate for most of the things that I was dressing myself for. And I felt like there was this big gap in the market. And I was like, someone someday should solve this problem. And I really didn't think I was going to do that. It was, you know, I had this kind of plan of, oh, I'm going to go into private equity and then maybe I'll go to business school and, you know, who knows. But I landed in a job that I absolutely hated. I was so miserable. I basically left within 4 months. And I thought at that point, I was like, oh my gosh, no one's going to hire me again. I've totally ruined my resume. Game over. I need to go employ myself. I should go start a business. I mean, the logic does not make any sense in retrospect. I probably could have gotten another
job.
And
in fashion, which
I know has like the worst success rates of probably any industry. I think like 1% of businesses make it to 10 years. So it was not a very calculated decision, you could say, but I was in a really low place. I think I was really in the lowest point of my professional confidence. And so I was like, you know what? I've got nothing to lose.
And you had negative to lose. You had negative $2,000 in your bank account.
That's so true.
I'm going to bring us back to that moment.
Yeah.
Give us a memory that captures the financial toughness of that time. And I mean, be honest, like if you had, you know,
obviously the support of your family. Yeah. That I think that's important. I think as entrepreneur, as when we share our stories, we're like, I lived in my car and then I like robbed a bank and then I raised $80 million with a back of the napkin pitch. And it's like most of us probably slept in our childhood twin bed.
Yes.
Until we launched.
Yeah, that's true. So I think kind of underlying all of this, and I have other friends now who are entrepreneurs or want to be entrepreneurs. And so I only can understand in that context, you know, but I had $35,000 saved up from the jobs that I had had. And so that was the money that I put, like I basically emptied my entire personal bank account and put all that money into my business bank account. Mm-hmm. And then my parents lent me $35,000. So I started with $70,000 in the bank account. I did not pay myself out of that money because that was going to go very quickly, especially in New York. And the first 3 months, basically, I just saw like my bank account dwindling. And I was like, this is not a good situation. So I started tutoring, which is a very nice way to make money in New York City. New York City parents are very stressed out about the SATs, et cetera. And so I would work on the business usually, you know, from morning till about 4 p.m. And then 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. I was tutoring. And
you have a Harvard degree, by the way, side hustle. I didn't go to Harvard, but I should have been tutoring. That's tutoring, so much money.
I actually made just as much money, almost as much money as my, as being a second year management consultant associate. It was a good gig.
Someone just left right now.
I know. Someone's like, I'm going to go tutor.
Door slammed.
And then I think the other part was like, this is like real talk, right? So when I said that when I left my last job, I was not in a good place. I was mentally really not in a good place. And I had started seeing this therapist who, by the way, was like out of network and charged $300 for a 45 minute therapist hour. And I was so naive. I didn't quite realize how serious this COBRA thing was. And so I didn't roll over in time to get COBRA. And there was this really scary moment where I thought I was going to owe my therapist $8,000. Which thankfully, my previous employer's HR department like squared away from me. So that was a phew. But when talking about one of the first things I did,
that's a lot of therapy.
Oh my gosh, totally. And like I needed it, right? I was like, this is like I need this. I cannot give it up. It's not a luxury.
Not to get too nerdy or granular, but what is like the biggest expense in the beginning, or the one that you made that you regret when you're launching an MM LaFleur?
Oh, branding. I spent $10,000 on branding. And
that, do you use it now?
No, it's not even like that the name of that company is a different name, you know? And they were like, we're going to pick your colors for you and we're going to design your logo for you and your branding for you. And I was like, and I think I was like, it was very much the early stages of direct to consumer businesses. And so yeah. I think I got caught up in that wave and I was like, I need a bang up logo.
That's such a common first step. I hear that all the time where I spend all this money on even, you know, virtual companies, all this design website, the branding, the website. And it's like, you don't even know what you're selling yet.
100%.
You don't know who your customer is yet.
And you know, by the way, like the resulting logo that they created for me was not so different from like the random logo I had picked in Microsoft Word. Right. And like the colors were, I mean, fine, but not all that better. So like, that's definitely one area where I wish I had not spent. But the best move probably, and like this goes into like this, Obamacare had not been invented at that point. So I forced my then boyfriend, thankfully now husband, but like to become my domestic partner so I could get on his health insurance.
You got to do what you got to do.
You got to do what you got to do. That's right. Yeah.
All right. Let's fast forward a little bit to the beginning of the pandemic. Especially, where were you? What were you thinking when we all got the same press release at the same time? It was like, lockdown happening now, social distancing happening now. Nobody is, you know, going into offices, let alone retail stores. Who's buying clothing attire in 2020? What were your fears at the time?
So we have manufacturing partners in Italy and China.
Oh my gosh.
And Japan, right? So those were actually the three countries that probably got hardest hit in the beginning. And so our factories in China started shutting down in January. Our fabric suppliers in Italy and Japan were also started shutting down. And so we were like, huh, this COVID thing sounds serious. But I think at that point we—
For them.
Yes. No, totally. Because I thought this
sounds
was going to be like Ebola, right? Like a terrible thing that happened in a continent that wasn't ours. And so, you know, we projected all these financial scenarios and I was like, yeah, sure. Like worst case, like, you know, take it down like 25%. And the reality like far surpassed those numbers. I mean, just to put into context, I think 2020 was down 50% to 2019. It was a—
Which actually isn't bad compared to what was happening in the world. Nobody was going— Who's coming in here and buying the Farnoosh dress in April of 2020?
Our very loyal customers, which I am so grateful for. But literally, we had customers being like, I literally have no place to wear this dress to, but like, okay, I guess I'll buy it.
We were doing that, weren't we? We were like, I remember that. But that didn't last very long. That sort of support, that, you know, you want to support your vendors and you were loyal to the people you were loyal to.
Yeah. I mean, I think at that point, as a brand, we had really never discounted. We used to do maybe one or two sales a year at most, and then we had to go into like hyper discount mode. I mean, it was painful, right? It kind of felt like this like beautiful baby that I had like nurtured and protected, and now I was like throwing it to the wolves, and I was like, you know, basically we were like sell it at cost or for less than cost because we have to just move our, like turn our inventory into cash. So it was, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, it was horrible. We had to close every single one of our stores. We furloughed our retail employees. We closed all retail doors. We ended up closing all retail doors. We had to go through three rounds of layoffs, one of which happened while I was on maternity leave. You know, I wasn't even, like physically around to really help execute that. And then the really hard discussion was whether or not we were going to keep the warehouse open. So we closed all the stores, but we were primarily still an e-commerce business. And then the question became, do we keep our warehouse open or not? And some people felt that we should close the warehouse, but if we close the warehouse, then our revenue would literally go to zero. And so that was a really tough discussion because at the same time, I don't know if you remember this, there was this conversation that actually COVID was transmitted through surfaces and fabric.
Oh, yeah.
So everyone was like washing everything when they got home or, you
Windexing
know,
your grocery delivery.
Exactly.
Wiping it down.
Leave it outside for 48 hours before bringing it into the house. And I was like, you know, we used to always joke like, well, at least our dresses don't kill people, you know, don't take your job too seriously. And then at that point, I was like, well, are we actually like just, you know, sending viruses in boxes? So that was such a hard decision. And ultimately, I decided to keep it open, but you could see how that could have played out also very differently.
Yeah. A lot of businesses say that the pandemic, while devastating and some didn't make it, those that did, they had to make really hard decisions as you did. But sometimes those decisions were the ones that endured.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't just a timely decision that then you go back to doing business as normal in 2023, that it was actually a brilliant idea or an acceleration of an idea they had. They were like, okay, well, someday we're going to, you know, do this. No, the time is now. Were there decisions like that that you made?
100%. I mean, I think we're a smarter business as a result. We had to get smart and make a lot of difficult trade-offs. The kind of nice to haves fell off the plate. I'm thinking of a concrete example. I mean, this is probably the most concrete example I could give you is our investors essentially said like, we can't backstop you anymore. Right. And so you're on your own. Like they were, while the pandemic was, maybe we thought it was going to be a 3-month thing or a 6-month thing. I think they were like, yes, you know, we're here for you. We'll support you. And then at some point they're kind of like, you're on your own now.
Well, may I ask a question about investors?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's such a rare opportunity to get money from investors, right? Especially as a woman. And it maybe even so in the industry of fashion, it's very competitive. And what do you think was your best selling point in those meetings that got you the money, the VC money?
The actual numbers. And I say this because, and I think I will say like, I think our investors, like I I really understand why they made the decisions they made. And I've also met not so nice investors, and our investors are actually very nice, supportive investors, but they will follow the numbers. And so I think initially when we raised our Series A, I think at that point I had really stopped pitching investors because so many of them were like, I don't understand this product. You know, I'm not a woman. My wife doesn't work. She doesn't really, like, you know, like it was like all of the things that you hear about in the news. And I was kind of like experiencing it firsthand. And the first Series A investor who really took a chance on me, the way I think he got comfortable is that he really like saw traction in the numbers. And so I think there are certainly companies and brands that can raise money on an idea. We were not able to. And really the money only came in after, because all these VCs, they're tracking your sales data through credit card data. Like you don't have to disclose your numbers to them for them to know how much you're making. They can actually track it pretty closely using credit card data. And so when the numbers just, you know, did what they did, that's when the offer started coming in. But I don't think I'm like, you know, I don't think I pitched a story that was all that special. I think we had to kind of get our way there, and then there was support around it. And I think, honestly, it's timing. Like, if you try to raise money now for a direct-to-consumer business from a VC, like, it's not happening.
Yeah.
Good luck to you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You want to know what's worse than shopping for jeans? Shopping for bras. It's never been fun for me until Third Love came into my life. Third Love was launched to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. They make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen probably since high school and have straps that actually stay put. Third Love's bras are designed at their headquarters in San Francisco, and they're made from premium materials. They put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before they're given the stamp of approval. And whether you're a AA or an H cup, their virtual fitting room can help find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups, so long feeling stuck between two cup sizes that just don't fit. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with the code podcast15. That's thirdlove.com to get $15 off your order with the code podcast15.
At the time, though, you were definitely filling a void. There was an underserved market. And we have some women today in the audience who are lawyers. And initially, when I know we spoke in 2017, your emoji or your avatar for the store, is that what you call it? Or like your profile, your target market.
Yes, yes, yes.
This isn't like MBA speak, you know, this is like social
media.
Your talk.
Emoji for your
emoji
business,
for your store.
For your customer, yeah.
But tell me, I should have asked this probably as we started, but tell me about what is the MM LaFleur brand, and where is it meeting the consumer and where they're not being met?
I'll just speak for myself. Like, I think So what we say at MM is the world's a better place when women succeed. And that's the overarching value. And there's so many ways to do that. And my way, the way that I derive joy in my career is by doing that through clothing. Mm. I say this with like some, maybe hesitation is not the right word, but you know, clearly I'm not running a nonprofit here, right? And I have experience also working in the nonprofit sector. I used to work at a refugee camp in Zambia, and then I worked in a nonprofit in South Africa. And it was like such an interesting experience. And ultimately I really decided that was not for me. Like I have so much respect for those types of careers. And I also realized I like being in fast-paced businesses where the results are in numbers. Mm-hmm. And I also really love being creative, and I'm not the designer, but I love having a creative partner who creates beautiful clothing. And I love thinking about my customer and how to market that clothing to her. So I think when we started MM, you know, we said like, okay, that's kind of the North Star. That's where we want to get to. And when I think about professional women, you know, what we talk about a lot about at MM is women on average spend 2 more weeks per year getting ready versus men, which like when you hear that factoid, it just kind of like, you're like, that can't be right. But like, I actually did the math myself. Like let's say my husband spends 15 minutes. Let's say I spend 45 minutes. I quickly got to 12 days a year. So like, you can see how that's very mm-hmm. possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the kind of question I posed was like, okay, what would it look like if we could give back some of that time to mm-hmm. women? Like, what if we could make it easier for her to get dressed in the morning? What if we made our clothes machine washable so she's not wasting money dry cleaning her things? You know, a $350 dress, if you dry clean it 10 times, is quickly an $800 dress. You know, if we could make it wrinkle resistant so she's not having to take out the ironing board at 7 a.m. I mean, God forbid, I don't even know where my ironing board is. Like, yeah. Right? Like, what, like, is it sounds like clothing, I think, in many ways is considered trite, but I think it has the superpower to transform the way, not only the way other people see you, but the way you feel about yourself that day. You know, like you can put on a jacket and suddenly you're like, I'm ready for business. You know, I think, I just think clothing has that magical power. And so I think that is where I've gravitated towards.
How has it evolved though since the pandemic? You're still inspiring success in your women consumers, and yeah. But how has the style changed? How has
like so much? I can't even. It's like kind of night and day. We were just actually looking at our top sellers from the most recent collection and the bottom sellers, and the top sellers were kind of all this like more evolved merchandise that really, you know, our design team mm-hmm. put forward during the pandemic, where we're saying like, you know, we know this hybrid lifestyle is here to stay. And what does that look like? And all the bottom sellers were actually kind of products that, you know, we had from the pre-pandemic days, where it's much more traditional, kind of office only. I think now the clothes that we carry primarily and that are our best sellers are really suited to this hybrid lifestyle. Like this, I was wearing with jeans on the weekend, but I throw a jacket over it and feels work appropriate. And like, so a lot of what we're, you know, selling are clothes that flex easily from yes. one situation to another. I think this like demarcation between like, these are my work clothes and like, these are my non-work clothes. I think that's,
yeah.
I don't see it as much.
I mean, I'm wearing my own dress, but these are MM boots.
They look great.
And this is what do you call this? The sweater.
This is the Moreland Jardigan.
Yeah. Jardigan.
Jardigan, the jacket cardigan.
Isn't that a great word? Jardigan. I love that. Well, since we last connected on the podcast, Sarah, you've grown the business, obviously, mm-hmm. and congratulations on all of that. Thank you. And your family.
Yeah.
Yes. So a little bit of a pivot, but I think it would be really amazing if we could hear a little bit about, because you also written about it and you've yeah. been very open about this.
Yeah.
You have 3 children. So I invited Sarah to a dinner in the fall when my book came out, and I hadn't, you know, we were just catching up, and she's telling me she has 3 children and they're all very similar in age. And I was like, you have triplets? Sort of. Tell me that story of how you have twins and a third child who is pretty much the same age as your twins.
Pretty much the same age, yes. Yeah. It's It's a long journey. The short version is 3 years of IVF, things not working out. I've got like a congenital condition. And so our doctor said, you should pursue surrogacy. And so we did. The first transfer with our surrogate failed. And so like at that point on the IVF journey, you're kind of like, well, this is my last stop, you know? And so I went back to my doctor and I said, I want to try one more time with a slightly different drug protocol. So that's actually, that's also like a different conversation, but like yeah. Do your research and advocate for yourself and you know, suggest things that you have no idea what you're talking about. But like, you know, my doctor was like, sure, we can try that. I don't think it's going to, you know, make a difference. Scientifically, it's not proven, but we can try. And I got pregnant that round, but I was convinced I would miscarry again. So I went back to our surrogate, her name's Trisha, and I said, hey, Trisha, like, I'm like 6 weeks, I think I was 4 weeks pregnant at that point. I was like, I'm 4 weeks pregnant, I'm probably not going to be able to like take this to term anyway. Wondering if you would still want to, you know, try carrying our baby for us. And she was like, absolutely. And she was also a mom of twin girls. And she was like, I think you should put two embryos in me. And so we're like, okay.
If you insist.
Yeah, basically.
And then twist my arm.
I know. It's true. I still remember that conversation with her. and then we called our doctor and we were like, you know, Trisha's saying like that we should try with two embryos. And he was like, sure, why not? The embryo qualities are so low, you'd be lucky if you got one. And so we were like, okay, I guess there's no like risk of twins. And so we did the transfer. Both stuck, wow. Miraculously.
Oh my gosh.
And that was the one time I didn't miscarry. And somehow, I actually think this is like a, I'm not saying this tongue in cheek. I think it was COVID. Just like not being on my feet. Mm. There's a body of work that's coming out on how like NICU rates in hospitals basically decreased significantly during the pandemic. And the only thing they can really correlate that to is women not being on their feet as much. So who knows? More work is being done there. I'm not a scientist, but that was how it happened.
Well, it's not a coincidence. I've heard stories of where the women, the couples will say, you know, we had a lot of difficulty conceiving through surrogacy. And so whether it was surrogacy, through IVF.
Yeah.
So they were either going to go through surrogacy or adopt.
Yeah.
But once you sort of defer, there's a piece that comes with that decision where it's yes. like, okay, it's not on me anymore to try to keep trying to do this.
Uh-huh.
And then your body does relax. So I don't know if it's not that you're not working or that you've just come to peace with it and there's a little bit less stress.
I think that's true. I think when Trisha got pregnant, I was like, oh, thank God. Like,
yeah.
This is probably not going to work and it's going to, but it might still be okay.
And so those women end up getting pregnant after they have like
that's
adopted.
True. 100%. And, I've heard that too.
I've seen the talk shows. But I read the story that you wrote for Marie Claire and I recommend everybody, you know, if you haven't read Sarah's essay, it was just, you know, I had so many emotions, obviously thrilled and happy, but very, you know, emotional and I'm sad for you at so many points because it was a very lonely journey. And I want to read a quote that your therapist shared with you. Was this the out-of-network $300?
This is the out-of-network
$300. I mean, talk about redeeming
themselves. Yeah, 100%.
But she said, your intent, Sarah, was always to have a family, not to get pregnant. Don't lose sight of the bigger goal here.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yes. And I said this in my article too, but she's not someone who gives a lot of her opinions. She's like, tell me how you feel about that. You know, that's kind of always her
tell
response.
Tell me about your mother.
Exactly.
Mene.
Yes. And, but she, that was like the one time where she gave very direct advice. And so I was like, I should listen closely.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Because I think I just kind of went down this tunnel where I was kind of doing every single medication. I mean, talk about expensive medication. It was like, you know, it was like one, and this is all like experimental stuff. So it's obviously not covered by insurance. And it would have been like, you know, $8,000 a procedure. And I had to do like 10 of those. And it was just like, I didn't do that, but it was like, you can get tunnel vision.
You had the entrepreneur brain on.
Yeah.
Where it's like, we will figure this out.
Yes, that's right.
And
that's right.
There is, as anyone who's become a parent, you know, there's so much you just have to like, you have to have faith and you just have to be like, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that experience, how that has translated into your life as a founder and as an entrepreneur, are you a little bit more, I don't know, has it changed you as an entrepreneur and the lens through which you see business and work?
This is like a lifelong question for me, but I think it's kind of coming to terms with the things I actually have control over versus those things I don't. And like IVF feels especially that way because you're like, it's my body. It's literally happening inside of me. I should be able to control the outcome of this. And at some point after round three, you realize I have like no control over the outcome.
Yeah.
Which is a very strange feeling. But I think one of the things, the negative way of saying it is you kind of start to disassociate. The positive way of saying it is you take the ups and downs. You're able to take both on the chin. And I think that's been very true of my entrepreneurship journey where like this is like – we were just talking about it, right? Like having your own business is like the highs are so high and the lows are so low. I used to feel that way. I would say like over the past 3-4 years, especially during COVID, like I have found a little bit of even keelness and I've been able to disassociate a little bit, which is hard because my name's on the door literally. But I found that to be like probably the most important, I'm going to say life lesson even.
Well, I would stop here, but I think I want to do what I've done in the past with this podcast. It's a throwback to the early days of So Money, and we have some loyal listeners in the audience. We're going to do a lightning round where I'm just going to ask you random questions and you're not going to overthink it.
I remember doing this with you. Oh my gosh.
Remember nothing.
So pressure. Okay.
This is a real throwback because I haven't done this in years, but maybe I should reinstate it.
I shouldn't have my wine.
And you just
wine.
Sort of fill in the blank.
Okay.
So if I can even remember. If I won the lottery tomorrow, like Powerball, I'm talking billion.
Yeah.
First thing I would do is just say give it to Farnoosh. I mean, that's
fine. Honestly, I would just invest it in my business. Obviously.
All right. More clothes for us.
Yeah. No, I was like, well, first I'd buy a yacht.
Yeah.
Then, yeah.
Sure. Right. By the yacht. There's room.
Right. Right.
You got
it. It will take up all of the $1 billion. Right.
That's great.
And then I'd invest it in my business, obviously.
The one thing I love to splurge on is,
I don't know if you call this a splurge, but baths, I probably take like 2 a day.
What?
Does it's a time splurge for sure.
Who's that designer at Ford? Who's he makes the men's suits and Tom Ford.
Tom Ford? Yeah.
Tom Ford takes 2 baths a day.
Tom Ford and me.
Maybe it's like a designer DNA thing.
It's also a Japanese thing. And now
you have time for 2 baths?
It's literally
Sorry,
5
I don't
minutes.
Mean to judge, but.
No, literally I wake up, right? I run down, I get my tea and I get my like special turmeric drink set up. And while I'm doing that, the bath is running.
Wow.
And then I come up and.
Good for you.
It's like in the morning it wakes
she
you up.
She says with a slight jealous tone
no,
in her voice.
Good for you.
Good for you.
In the morning it wakes you up. At night it puts me to bed. It's like, it's the best thing.
I love
thing.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to start doing that, I
it's
guess.
Like, it's, it does,
I won't.
You don't need more than 10 minutes for a bath.
That's true. Tell my daughter that though. She thinks it's,
it's true.
Much work. All right. The one thing that I wish I had learned about money growing up is?
You can only take more risks if you're wealthy.
You can only take more risks if you're wealthy. So it's a privilege to take risks. I kind of 100% believe that.
Yeah.
Pete, you know what I also say? If you're fearless, that's a nice privilege.
100%. Like, I think
privilege.
There's this like, you know, oh, wow, like. I think that's actually like, I'm not to attack the American dream here, but like most of our most successful entrepreneurs, like they weren't necessarily uber wealthy, but like they grew up in nice, comfortable homes where like taking risk was a possibility.
An exception to this is I once interviewed a billionaire, and he wasn't always, obviously. He actually started in poverty. He was the son of a single mother, an immigrant. They lived in a drug-infested neighborhood, and all the things. And he said his best advantage, and I guess you can call it a gift, which is like, I mean, I don't recommend this as a way of life, but he was like, being poor was what drove me to take risks, because he said, I had literally nothing to lose.
Yeah.
I already knew what rock bottom was.
Yes.
So what's below rock bottom? I don't know.
I really respect that.
Yeah. Jean-Paul DeJoria, he owns Patron Tequila and Paul Mitchell.
So never look at that the same way again.
Yeah. But again, don't recommend that as a recipe for making turning yourself into a billionaire. And I'm so money because, here, let me take that back. I'm Sarah LaFleur. I'm so money because.
I let money buy me time, but I don't let it control me.
I love that. Wonderful. Thank you so much. I told you we'd have a great story here tonight. Thank you so much, Sarah. And thank you for joining.
I do, first of all, thank you. And I keep telling Farnoosh this, but she very kindly invited me to a dinner that she hosted for her book launch. And I was like, oh my gosh, this woman should have her her own stand-up comedy show. She's so funny. But I cannot recommend A Healthy State of Panic more. What I loved about it is I think actually, we hear this a lot in the investing world, which is like women tend to not take risks, and so all the startup backers tend to be men, and that, there is a truth to that. But so I think what is often said is women don't make money, men make all the money because they're able to take risks. And I think actually what I love about your book is how it turns that concept on its head. And again, I don't want to say like being fearful is more of a feminine quality than a masculine one, but if we were to overgeneralize here.
I'll say it. The world's a scary place right. when you're a woman.
Totally. But like how that can actually...
I'm not walking out of here alone.
Yeah, 100%. It can be used to your advantage. And I just thought that was like such a fresh way of thinking about your relationship with money.
Yeah.
That it can actually like all of those like...
like you're okay actually.
Yeah.
Like if you're not afraid... If you are afraid, you're doing it right.
Right, exactly.
If you're afraid asking for more money, you're doing it right because you're pushing boundaries. You're getting outside of your comfort zone. If you're not afraid and you're asking your boss for more money, you're probably asking for what's too simple.
Yeah.
Because you're confident they're going to say yes.
Yes. So anyway, highly recommend.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much to Sarah LaFleur for joining us. If you would like to help me host a live So Money podcast, get in touch. You can email me, farnoosh@somoneypodcast.com. You can direct message me on Instagram. If you couldn't tell, I really enjoyed being in real life with you, with our guests. It is an unmatched experience, and I'd love to do more of it this year. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you back here for a fresh episode of Ask Farnoosh on Friday. I hope your day is so money. Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.